The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast, which comes to you hot from day four of the Edinburgh International Books Festival. Or perhaps that should be cool, as the weather is on the turn here, with the rain dribbling down and the sun making an increasingly feeble attempt to break through the clouds. I'm Claire Armstead and I'm books editor of The Guardian and Observer. The weather is also on the turn in today's podcast. After yesterday's odyssey through Ireland literature and American politics, today's is going to venture deep into two of the most wayward brains in contemporary literature. Alistair Gray is here to introduce his collected short stories. Ned Bowman unleashed his second novel, The Teleportation Accident, just longlisted for the Booker Prize. Here he is, reading from the novel.
I'm going to read from early in chapter two, describing the situation in Berlin in 1933, which, as you can imagine, is turning pretty dark. By early 1933, even the most heedless and egotistical Berliner, so even Lerse, couldn't help but notice that something nasty was going on. At parties now, optimism had given way to dread and yells to whispers. The really good times were never coming back, and to think what might come next was just too horrible. Of course, it was mainly young working-class toughs who had propelled this awfulness at the beginning, but now people of every generation and every class had joined the brainless charge. They seemed to think that just because the civilised solutions of the 1920s had begun to falter, that was a reason to dash headlong in the opposite direction. Most of Lerse's friends agreed that something urgently needed to be done, but no one had any idea how to fight what was somehow already so dominant. Some had even begun to talk about leaving the country, at least until sanity was restored. German history was at a turning point. In fact, Lerse could still remember the first time he had heard of this new drug, ketamine. Everyone had taken the train up to an estate north of Ritterbrücke that belonged to somebody's absent parents. It was one of those country parties where it felt as if no matter where you went, you were always being watched by either a live horse or a dead stag, until you found yourself lingering by the wash basin after a piss, just to escape this weirdly oppressive ungulate panopticon. At about midnight, bored with playing hide-and-seek, Lerse had wandered out to the back lawn where the jazz band was performing, hoping to find a girl to dance with. Instead, he nearly tripped over a boy who lay flexing and humming in the grass and looked around to see several others in the same state. So when he spotted Hildkraut, he went over to ask him if there had been a mustard gas attack, since they couldn't all be so drunk already. And Hildkraut explained that they'd taken a black market horse tranquilizer called ketamine, at which point Lerse began to feel as if he had slipped into some sort of Dada world. Why on earth would anyone voluntarily take horse tranquilizer? Because they can't get good coke anymore. They can't get good coke anymore, so this is the logical alternative. Yeah. Started with scummy kids from the suburbs, then it got to the art schools, and now everyone takes it. What does it do? Said Lerse. You feel as if you're being sucked down this fathomless, gloomy tunnel. Or, to put it another way, it's as if all the different weights and cares of the world have been lifted from your shoulders to be replaced by a single, much larger sort of consolidated weight. Your limbs stop working and you can't really talk. If you take enough, then it can last for hours and hours, but it seems like even longer because time slows down. Hildkraut smiled wistfully. It's fantastic. At their feet, somebody groaned softly as if in enthusiastic assent. And it makes Wagner sound really good. I'm sorry to be obtuse, said Lerse, but has everyone gone insane? I take coke because it's fun. I take coke because it makes me feel confident and talkative and full of energy, or at least it used to when it wasn't mostly brickdust. If I want to feel as if I'm being sucked down a fathomless gloomy tunnel for hours and hours, then I have a complete set of Schopenhauer at home. Well, anyway, the story is that Brogman once took so much that he blacked out and then woke up in a stable surrounded by actual horses. Explain that. After interrogating several other people at the party, Lerse concluded that he was the last person in Germany to have heard of ketamine. But nobody offered him any. And after that episode, as the months passed, fashionable Berlin nightlife distorted into an unrecognisable parody. Nobody seemed to laugh or dance or kiss anymore. They just lay around slurring and drooling, vanquished until morning. Certainly, most of his worthwhile friends didn't bother with ketamine. Why would they, when they still remembered what proper drugs were like? But they were 25 or 26 now, and it was the 19 and 20-year-olds who had all the clout. For the first time in his life, Lerser had a sense of what the early days of expressionism must have felt like to the prior generation of realists. Not only did he almost begin to miss the exhausting and obnoxious conversations he used to have with people who were inconsiderate enough to have done more coke than him, he also almost began to envy Achleiner off in the mountains with his new Nazi friends, far away from all this tranquilizer nonsense that had a real chance of ruining what was otherwise quite a promising decade.
So Ned, you've just done an event at Edinburgh and you've managed to offend the whole of Scotland, I should imagine, by describing it as the home of ketamine. Explain yourself.
Well, I'm just identifying what I see as a statistical tendency. I mean, but it's cultural. So like a lot of the best Scottish bass music that's come out of Edinburgh and Glasgow recently, kind of quite openly linked with ketamine. And as I said in the event, Scotland is the first person I saw someone wearing a ketamine Just Say Nay t-shirt.
As in the horse, just say nay.
Yeah, there's even an additional pun which I wanted to identify in the text, but I thought it would be too show-offy, which is that he says that he slipped into a Dada world, and the word Dada comes from a name for someone's toy horse, but I thought it would just be too much to like add that extra allusion.
You've introduced us to Egon, who is, you describe, as heedless and egotistical, which is one of the criticisms that was levelled at your first novel, Boxer Beetle. It's almost like you're deliberately taunting the people who've accused you of weaknesses.
One of the kind of touchstones for this book was Larry David's work on Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And apparently, in fact, this is in one of the episodes, people apparently quite often say to him, like, what's it like to write a character that's as loathsome as George or like Larry on Curb Your Enthusiasm? Like, how do you even come up with all those terrible things that he does? And he says, everything that's in there is stuff that I have done. So the egotism and heedlessness in it is only me, I think, making a more honest expression of my personality that was there in the first book, but perhaps not as, like, unveiled.
The passage you just read is in 1933, but it sort of ranges through the period just before the war, the Second World War, and obviously hanging over it is the Holocaust, and that also hung over Boxer Beetle. What's it with the Holocaust? What's it with that period of history for you?
Well, actually, I was about a third of the way into writing this, and I thought, oh, my God, why am I writing another Holocaust novel? And also, there's that great Elif Batuman piece where she writes about creative writing courses and the rise of them. And she coins this phrase, which is the techno-modernist Holocaust novel, which is what she says that people who do creative writing programs tend to write. And I haven't done a creative writing program, but I read that and I was like, oh my God, I have written two techno-modernist Holocaust novels, except I couldn't have summed it up as concisely as that. So a lot of it was me thinking, why have I done this? How is this not going to be redundant even within my own career? How can I make this interesting again?
Another line in that reading that I want to pick you up in is, it's at what expressionism must have felt like to the previous generation of realists. Your name-calling, that English tradition of writing fiction, and this is a mashup of lots and lots and lots of different genres. You go through hardboil, there's romance in it, there's science fiction in it.
Yeah, well, I had a sense when I was writing this that after this, maybe I should like grow up a little bit as a writer and sort of take my own intentions a bit more seriously. So given that, it was a little bit like kind of the last party before you start a new job. I wanted to do all the things in this book that I thought I might not have an opportunity to do in the future. So that's why I put in as many genres as I possibly could, because this might, I mean, I'm probably not going to write another book with any room for Lovecraft in it. So that was why I put Lovecraft stuff in this one.
You name check him quite a lot, don't you?
When I was writing this, I thought that around the same time that it came out, Guillermo del Toro was going to come out with his adaptation of At the Mountains of Madness, so I would be riding this like wave of Lovecraft appreciation, but then that fell apart, so I'm not. But I think it's fine because you find so many Lovecraft fans in unexpected places. I think almost everyone who's read him ends up becoming a little bit obsessed because he's such a unique writer. And also I really think he's a kind of reluctant modernist. Like, if you read him allegorically, like, he can be just as interesting as Kafka or Borges. And I've even got this idea for an essay comparing Lovecraft to The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, which is my favourite book, because The Good Soldier is so much about, like, drawing back this veil on the genteel world and discovering this inexpressibly evil thing lurking within that's always been there, but you were too naive to see it. And that's exactly what Lovecraft was about. And then, but I also love just, like, all the tentacles and the mad scientists and the, like, non-Euclidean architecture. And I'd been hoping for so long to find a way to write about that in a way which wasn't just, like, a pastiche story. So, yeah, it was a treat to include a little bit of that.
So tell us exactly how Lovecraft is manifest in this.
Well, in the novel, I sort of imagine that Cordell Hull, who was the Secretary of State of the US at the time the book is set, reads Lovecraft and just takes it all to be true, and then starts kind of shaping part of the national defense policy on that basis. So one of the scientists in this book is given Lovecraft's letters that have been steamed open and reproduced, which again didn't really happen as far as I know, but he's given these letters in the hope of scientifically pursuing some of Lovecraft's revelations. And then one of the means he pursues them is that there's this sort of question about whether this accident that took place in a Parisian opera house was the result of this great stage designer called Lavaccini making a pact with cosmic evil in the way that people do in Lovecraft novels, with, you know, tentacles slithering out from the proscenium arch and so on. So it's this sense that maybe Lovecraft is real, and that's the excuse for a lot of the characters in the book to start investigating these things.
And that anecdote brings us to the title of the book, which you say functions on 9 different levels. Can you recite the 9 levels on which the title, The Teleportation Accident, function?
So there's the original teleportation accident, which takes place in a Parisian opera house in the 17th century. There's the teleportation accident with Lursa, which opens the book, which takes place on a stage in Weimar Berlin. There's a teleportation accident later in the novel, which I can't spoil. Lursa's working on a play called The Teleportation Accident. Rupert Rackenham, who's this writer in it based on Isherwood, publishes a novel called The Teleportation Accident. Then, on a sort of slightly more tenuous level, The Teleportation Accident sort of refers to the Holocaust, and it refers to the death in a car crash of Lursa's parents. And it refers to Lursa, who kind of hates Weimar Berlin but at the same time is very at home there, somehow finding himself almost by accident in LA where he has no idea where he is. And then finally, on a self-referential level, it refers to, I was trying to write a book in which a character from a sort of, like, quite realist but comic and quite flippant 1930s maybe British comic novel like Evelyn Waugh or Woodhouse or whoever, a character from that found himself sort of bewilderedly in, like, a more postmodern and very American 1960s novel like V or The Crying of Lot 49.
So in what sense is the Holocaust like a teleportation accident?
The sort of most callous way to answer that is that one way of looking at the Holocaust is that people go into a chamber, the door of the chamber is closed and locked, something happens inside which is sort of impossible to explain and quite secret, and then when you open the chamber, the people aren't there anymore and you don't know where to find them. I would never write a novel that's actually about someone going to a concentration camp or anything, like, partly because I don't have the emotional artistic resources to do that, but also partly because you can't, or at least not yet, take my, like, jokey postmodern approach to that. I mean, maybe you could, maybe someone could write a brilliant novel like that, but I would feel a bit uncomfortable doing that. Whereas when you're writing about all these people in the orbit of those events and the kind of ways that those events would permeate the lives of people who were too selfish to care, I feel much more okay about bending history and satirizing history and just, like, making things up out of whole cloth.
Andy Stanton, creator of Mr. Gum, the Biscuit Billionaire, is just as wacky as our other two guests. His talk reduced 500 children to tears of laughter with its irreverent references to Harry Potter, the Gruffalo, and Jacqueline Wilson. So we asked what he was thinking about today.
Hello everyone, I am Andy Stanton and I'm here at the Edinburgh Book Festival 2012. I'm thinking about a lot of things. Mostly what I'm thinking about is my event yesterday where, I don't know how this happened exactly, but during the questions part of the event I somehow told 500 or 600 people that I've seen Jacqueline Wilson kill a dog. And I'm wondering today if I should have said that. It sort of split the room. And I didn't just say it once, I then brought it back into the event later on and again talked about Jacqueline Wilson killing dogs, and I really don't think I should have said any of that. And now what I'm thinking about is why I'm telling you guys about this, because it's only just going to get worse now, isn't it?
And now to Alistair Gray, the veteran Scottish painter and writer who came to launch a landmark collection of his stories. But nothing is as straightforward as that in Gray's world, as the audience found out.
Here's a lighter, very much lighter, poem, called A Scottish Author's Lament. Everyone over middle age regrets the losses aging brings. My principal regret is this: I've never tackled handy things. Before King Louis lost his head, his hobby was repairing locks. Byron, despite a crippled foot, wrote epics, yet could swim and box. Benjamin Franklin and Mark Twain were excellent compositors. The Reverend Sidney Smith had skill to doctor his parishioners. One housewife writes as well as me, Agnes Owens. One shipyard worker sang good tunes, Billy Connolly. One muralist can fell a tree. I won't go through the names, but I have them. One muralist can fell a tree. One postman publishes cartoons. One sweeper of streets can etch and paint. One banker played the bagpipes well. One fisherman became a saint who holds the keys of heaven and hell. I, who have written many books, cannot repair a dripping tap or sew a button on a shirt. Why am I such a useless chap? Ruskin swept stairs and weeded plots. D.H. Lawrence scrubbed his floors. Count Tolstoy emptied chamber pots. Why do I flinch from household chores? Burns ploughed, and James Hogg herded sheep. Frost farmed and Conrad sailed the sea. Jim Kelman drove an omnibus. No honest work excuses me.
For all his humour, he is a man who is deadly serious at heart.
What's on your mind? What are you thinking about?
The referendum for Scottish independence, which I favour, of course. Home rules always struck me as a good idea. I've always thought that putting soldiers of one nation into a nation that's in another continent or across many other nations away is a rotten thing to do, but it's being done all the time nowadays by America and Britain. Of course, Britain has a tradition of doing it. At present, there seems to be a wee bit of crisis because quite a lot of supporters of the Scottish referendum want to get rid of the military bases that have been planted in Scotland by the London government's treaties with the USA. I also, being a CND supporter of many years standing, 50 years standing, oh, more than that, would like to get rid of these. The difficulty seems to be that there's a danger of those who want to get rid of these blights on our economy, blights on our world, disrupting the only party in Scotland that might get us the independence, that might lead us to get rid of them. I mean, of course, the pro-unionists will use this to try to prise the party Alex Salmon leads apart. Oh, dear, isn't politics complicated?
But there is, to be fair, an economic reason for keeping them, because quite a lot of people make a bit of a living out of having them there, doesn't
there? Oh, yes! You know, Hangman made a great deal of a living out of hanging people when we had corporal punishment. It is true that since Britain has been deindustrialised, our major industry now is arms manufacture. A hell of a lot of people make money out of that. Not just the workers who are putting together weapons and booby traps and all kinds of filthy contrivances, but chiefly the people who have invested in these industries. Some trade unions have done it. Academics have done it. The pension fund of our universities have invested in this filthy business. How can you expect any sensible government to go against that?
In independence in general, is there a kind of broader reason other than demilitarising?
Well, everybody should have independence. Nobody should be used as a tool by other folk. Particularly not their paymasters if they're being paid to do something nasty. I mean, that was poor old Eichmann's excuse. I was told to do it. I was paid to do it. I was just doing my job.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.